This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi guys, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 32, Max Schollenberger. On Monday, September 14th, 2020, the announcement of the arrests of a couple living in Annville, Pennsylvania, shocked and horrified the small, tight-knit community. No one outside the house at 30 South White Oak Street had any idea that for an untold length of time, a little boy had suffered unthinkable horrors inside the home, while the normal lives of those in his community and even his own family went on around him. Although Maxwell Schollenberger was 12 years old, he had never been enrolled in school, hadn't seen a doctor in 10 years, and ultimately died in his own filth after years of being confined in an unlit bedroom, starved and beaten. My guest on today's episode is Max's biological mother, Sarah, who was separated from her son for years while his father dodged her attempts to contact him and moved his family from place to place. She has not yet made a public statement, so this is the first time we'll hear Sarah's side of the story. This is the unfathomably tragic story of Max Schollenberger. My sources for this week were NBC4, Unified Judicial System of Pennsylvania web portal, Penn Live Patriot News, Lebanon Daily News, Facebook, New York Post, WGAL8, Fox 43, The Pocono Record, Law and Crime, and Max's mom, Sarah. Before I play my interview with Sarah, I'm going to give you the facts of Max's case as they've been revealed over the past few weeks. Be warned, some of these details are very disturbing. Around noon on May 26, 2020, police in Annville, Pennsylvania, discovered the emaciated body of 12-year-old Maxwell Thomas Schollenberger in his family's home at 30 South White Oak Street. Max was found naked and smeared with feces, slumped across a filthy bed in a bedroom with feces caked on every surface. Piles of human waste under the bed had begun to grow mold. Claw marks appeared in the feces staining the bedsheets. The bedroom in which he was held captive had no electric light. The windows were secured shut with screws, and the shades were duct-taped closed, preventing anyone from seeing in or out, as well as preventing any natural light from leaking in. The bedroom door was locked from the outside with three metal hooks. The feces-encrusted bed was the only furniture in the room. There were no toys in the room, and the only clothing present was covered with feces. A red plastic cup on the floor next to the bed contained about an inch of water. The odor of human waste permeated the entire second floor of the house. Immediately, due to the conditions in the home, police requested help from the Lebanon County Detective Bureau. Investigators soon discovered that Max's father, 42-year-old Scott Fremont Schollenberger Jr., and Scott's fiancée, 35-year-old Kimberly Marie Maurer, were also raising other children, three of whom were the couple's biological children, and were under the age of five. Kim's two teenagers from a previous relationship lived in the house part-time. All of the other kids were described as appearing to be healthy, well-adjusted, and cared for. They attended school, received medical care, and seemed to have typical relationships with their parents. Max, who was born on December 8, 2007, had not been seen by a doctor in 10 years, and apparently had never been enrolled in school. Even his siblings, who lived in the same house, rarely saw him. In fact, Scott and Kim had ordered the children not to speak to Max. According to officials, Max's siblings reported hardly ever seeing the victim prior to his death. Some of the defendant's family and friends also reported not seeing the victim in quite some time, and some were not even aware of his existence. Neighbor Nicholas Rivera said he occasionally saw Scott or Kim outside the home with the other children, but no one living nearby even knew the couple had another child. Rivera said,
I've been here for 3 years. I have neighbors that have been here for 10 years. They never even seen this kid.
The day before Max's body was found, Rivera said,
Memorial Day, they had a big family picnic. There was maybe 20 people coming in and out of the house all the time. There was a pool set up for the kids in the backyard and everything. Some older people were there, maybe the grandparents or something. I don't know.
Authorities said that Kim had been a caregiver for Max since he was 2 years old. I'd like to imagine they were using the term caregiver sarcastically. Kim even told police that she, not Scott, provided most of the care for Max because her husband expressed extreme frustration toward his son and was afraid of hurting him. Both the boy's father and stepmother denied Max had any mental or physical disorders, although stories they had given other people over the years seemed to contradict those claims. A forensic autopsy was completed on Max's body at Lehigh Valley Hospital on June 1st by Dr. Michael W. Johnson. Max was described as very thin, his stomach bloated. At the time of his death, he weighed a scant 47.5 pounds, which is about half the average weight of a boy his age, and he was also about 8 inches shorter than the average for his age. He had next to no muscle mass, and his bones had weakened due to malnutrition. Investigators believe that he would have been too weak to walk or even bear his own meager weight. By the time he died, he could no longer digest food. There was calcification in his stomach, and his intestines could no longer process food. He had also suffered head trauma and internal bleeding. Max's death was ultimately ruled a homicide caused by blunt force trauma complicating starvation and malnutrition. Scott and Kim were arrested on Friday, September 11th, and each was charged with homicide and conspiracy to commit homicide, both first-degree felonies, as well as 2 second-degree felonies, endangering the welfare of a child by a parent, and conspiracy to commit the same. They're being held without bail due to the nature of the charges. At the time of his arrest, Scott was unemployed, and Kim apparently attempted to make money by shilling Scentsy products on Facebook. Lebanon County District Attorney Pierre Hess Graff gave a press conference about Max's case on the morning of Monday, September 14th, saying that in her 11 years as prosecutor, she had never seen anything like Max's horrific treatment and demise.
Today we take the first step in the long path of justice for the murder of a 12-year-old child, Maxwell Max Schallenberger. This little boy, in his bedroom, he had not one toy, no furniture aside from the bed where he died. This little boy had nothing other than the bed. The bed itself was soaked, was covered in fecal matter and the child's human waste. This child could not escape that bedroom. When our detectives examined the door, they found exterior eyelet hooks on the outside frame, locks, latches. When they went on the inside of the bedroom had windows, but they were entirely restricted. Those windows had louvered shutters screwed into the window frames themselves. The blinds, the curtains, were duct taped to the window. That little boy in his suffering could not see out. The community, even if it knew to look for him, could not see in. And that child died, suffering entirely alone in the darkness. Dr. Michael Johnson performed the little boy's autopsy. He examined his tiny body. He found atrophied limbs containing little to no muscle mass. He found weakened bones consistent with starvation and malnutrition. He found evidence of ongoing, constant, and consistent neglect. And throughout that little boy's body, he found hemorrhaging and internal bleeding. Both defendants acknowledged their ongoing responsibility for care, that this child, this little boy, was their responsibility. Despite that, Max Schallenberger was never enrolled in school. He was 12 years old when he was killed. The defendants had not taken that child to the doctor, had not gotten any medical care in over a decade. What we found was that these two defendants have biological children together. Those children reside in the same home where Max Schallenberger was abused, was neglected, and where he died. And those children, their children together, all appeared happy, healthy, and well cared for. Those children go to the doctor, and those children went to school. We interviewed the other children in the home. They would describe the foul stench that emanated from Max Schallenberger's bedroom, how they were told to ignore him and to not talk to him. One child described when our defendants would enter that little boy's bedroom. That child would scream and he would cry. There was an abundance of food in the kitchen and in all the cabinets. And that food clearly went to feed every other person inside that household besides Max Schallenberger. Cases which involve children are the most haunting for our community, but also for our investigators. Max Schallenberger existed. I will not call this living, and I never will. He existed in a state of perpetual suffering. He existed in the most deplorable, the foulest, the most heinous of human conditions. This tiny 12-year-old boy never knew the unconditional warm love of a family. The sheer despair, the sheer suffering that was Max Schallenberger's life now demands justice for his death. And that is exactly what we intend to do with these charges.
As for whether CYS was ever involved, Graff said that police were never contacted about any crime or suspected child abuse going on in the home. No one outside the home could see into Max's bedroom because the windows were covered and sealed shut. There were no outward signs of abuse that would have triggered an investigation with CYS. When asked about Max's biological mother, Graff said,
"Biological mother is in contact with law enforcement. In terms of custody, it was Scott Schallenberger, biofather, the defendant in this case, who had live-in full-time custody. It doesn't appear at this point that biological mother was in contact or any type of communication with this little boy for quite some time."
One reporter asked why, since Max died in May, Scott and Kim were not arrested until September.
So in the past few months, what we've been doing is frankly our job. We're doing our investigation to make sure it's as thorough and locked in as it can possibly be. Children and Youth was involved with the family to make sure that the other children were safe, that they were cared for. That happened from the onset of the investigation. However, forensic things such as autopsies, they take time. Doctors need additional consultations, that takes time. We wanted to make sure the children were interviewed. We wanted to make sure every possible person that we could find that we knew of was interviewed. And that's what we've been doing for the last few months. As of Friday, to the best of our knowledge, Scott Schallenberger had not been living in the residence where the child died. We had to look for him. He was located in Philadelphia. He was taken into custody without incident and was immediately returned to Lebanon County. Both defendants were arraigned by John Ditzler and were given no bail in light of the nature of the charges.
There's no indication whatsoever as to why Max was singled out, held captive in a dark bedroom, beaten, and starved for months or possibly years, and Graff could not discuss a motive in Max's death, saying it would be discussed at trial. We have seen this kind of targeting in previous cases. Unfortunately, it is not uncommon for abusive parents to single out one child as scapegoat. Graff said the death penalty cannot be sought in this case because it does not meet the legal criteria for aggravating factors. Graff said Max's siblings are safe and Children and Youth Services is now involved. According to court records, it doesn't appear Scott Schallenberger or Kimberly Maurer have been in legal trouble before, aside from evidently being evicted by a landlord in 2016. The couple had owned the home where Max died since a real estate transfer took place in October of 2017. Over the summer, Scott was charged with simple assault by Annville police. He was out on bail from that charge when he was arrested for Max's murder. That charge stemmed from an incident on July 9, 2020, when Annville police were called to the family's home on an assault report. According to township records, Kim told police that Scott hit her when he returned home at about 7 that morning after a night out. Scott was reportedly angry about something that happened with a friend, Kim said, and when she asked him if he had been out drinking all night, he hit her. A police officer on the scene took note of swelling above Kim's eye. Scott was charged with simple assault in that incident, after which a protective order was issued against him, barring him from entering the home or having contact with his family. He spent some time having a pity party on Facebook about his perceived betrayal by Kim, posting on July 22nd,
"How can someone be so evil?"
Followed by,
"This is the most evil situation I have ever seen in my life. I was a good dad. I worked so hard for my family and now they are all gone. I don't understand."
A jury trial for the assault charge has been scheduled for November. Scott Schallenberger and Kimberly Maurer were arraigned on their charges on September 11th. Both were scheduled for a preliminary hearing at 8 a.m. on September 24th before Magisterial District Judge John Ditzler, but due to a power outage, it was continued until the following week. On the morning of October 1st, Scott and his attorney waived his preliminary hearing, which means his charges were advanced for trial. Kim's hearing, however, was continued for another week. It would appear the two won't be tried together if either or both make it to trial without pleading out, which remains to be seen. The community of Annville and Lebanon County have been hit hard by Max's death, and multiple online groups have formed to discuss both the case and positive changes that could be made in its wake. A memorial has grown in front of the house where Max died, where citizens have left signs, poems, balloons, candles, toys, and other offerings as symbolic gestures to show how much love the community has for this little boy. Marches have been organized outside the Lebanon County Courthouse, where concerned citizens carried signs bearing Max's name, demanding justice for him. There has been some discussion among community members about raising funds to tear down the Schallenberger House of Horrors and possibly build a park or a memorial to Max on the site, although its location on a busy street is a point of contention for some. Some have also talked about pushing for law reform, suggesting Max's law should seek stiffer penalties for child abusers. Many have wondered where Max's biological mother has been all this time. In the weeks since the arrests were announced, she hasn't yet made a public statement. I got in touch with Sarah through one of the online Facebook groups, and we ended up having a lengthy Zoom conversation last week. It was hard to condense our three-hour conversation to fit into one episode because there are so many important details in her story about how she became separated from her son. Please listen to her story with an open heart. Without further ado, here's my interview with Max's mom, Sarah. Today on the podcast, I have a very special guest who hasn't yet spoken publicly about her son's story. Max's mother, Sarah, is on the podcast with me. Thanks so much for joining me, and I appreciate you talking about Max with me and going over what's going on, because I know you've had a lot of negative feedback about what went on and where you were, so I want to help you get that cleared up. Can you tell me a little bit about what Max was like as a little guy?
I had him later on in life. I had actually made it to 27 before I had him, and he was just the most perfect little being I'd ever seen in my life. He looked like one of those little precious moments cherubs that you see at the Hallmark stores, platinum blonde hair and crystal blue eyes, very fair skinned. He looked like a spitting image of Scott. Like, it looked like I had no involvement whatsoever in his development. He could have been a carbon copy. No issues. He was healthy, smart. He hardly ever cried. He was born with a little stork bite on his nose, which we had investigated through Hershey Med Center. At 3 months old, he was doing MRIs and CT scans. Everything came out clear. He was perfect. He met all his milestones on time. Growth and development was fine. He was a little chubby baby, but the kid liked to eat. Always pleasant. You know, he brought a smile to everybody he ever met. He loved his family. He was just the sweetest kid.
So just to clear it up, there was no reason for anyone to believe he had any substances in his blood at birth or any special needs at all.
No, absolutely not. They did a full panel screen when he was born. I was a higher risk pregnancy since I had been born without a soft spot in my head. There's a medical term for it, which escapes me, but something that they were monitoring. But I'm healthy all the way throughout. I actually was working full time up until 3 days before I gave birth, still doing 40 hours a week.
Basically, it sounds like a lot of that after the fact was made up by Scott.
There was nothing like that with Maxwell. Even the detectives, when they questioned me, asked if he had any sort of learning disabilities or difficulties. Maxwell didn't act out. He didn't cry. He didn't scream. He didn't get angry. You know, he was always happy, laughing, smiling, polite, please, thank you. And he was potty trained. When Scott took him from me, he was potty trained.
I asked Sarah to talk about how she and Scott met and the progression of their relationship.
I had moved here in 2006. I was living in the Pittsburgh area, and I came to stay with some family here, start everything anew. I'd met Scott when I'd start working. He was working in the kitchen, and unlike any man I'd ever dated before, tall, handsome, strong, authoritative. He was intimidating in his stature. He had a real deep voice. He had just gone through a divorce at the time where he also had a son from his marriage. And I could tell he loved his little boy. It broke his heart having to be apart from him. And I could tell that. He was struggling financially, you know, paying child support, working hard. It just kind of made sense that we joined forces. You know, obviously I couldn't stay with family forever. So we got together, you can say things moved kind of fast. We found out I was pregnant about 3 months after we started dating. And this was, you know, my first child. So, of course, I'm scared. I didn't know what to expect. Obviously, we weren't trying for this, but miracles happen. It wasn't his first rodeo. So he was excited at first. He was ecstatic about the idea. Came to find out later on that he had a few more that were kind of undocumented. He actually had kept the fact that he had another child from me until a few months into the relationship, where he kind of sprung on me, oh yeah, and I have a daughter as well, but they never did any paperwork on that. He only got to see his other son like every other weekend for a couple hours. We did do overnights once in a while, but very attentive, very loving. You know, that was his world. When was there, his focus was on him. He was doing the best he could. He wasn't very responsible with money at all, spent beyond his means. His version of destitute and broke was slightly different than mine. You know, he'd say, oh, I've got, you know, no food in the house. And, you know, he still had canned goods and cereal and frozen things. Like, I don't know if that meant that, you know, he didn't have all the things that he liked. It was an ideal situation. You know, he did spend beyond his means. Early on in the relationship, he was trying to talk me into getting, like, leasing a brand new car. I just wasn't comfortable putting my credit on the line for something like that. You know, easily we could go find something used, or, you know, something we can pay off completely instead of having, you know, we're trying to get an apartment, a house, we've got a family on the way. It just didn't make sense to add an expense like that to the mix at that juncture in time. You know, we got a child. Babies are very expensive. He liked what he liked. He demanded respect. You could tell that he was always seeking some sort of validation. He suffered from a lot of insecurities. I don't know if that was a product of his upbringing. You know, I know his father was really hard on him. His mother had a history of severe drug use to the point where she actually had her stomach removed. She was really bad up. He didn't really like to talk about it a lot. It really made him emotional. But I know his father was very hard on him. Little things would set him off. If you're eating too loudly, like if you happen to chew like with your mouth open, he would become outraged. He almost flipped the table over. You know, apart from the issues that we had, like, I supported him from day one, anything that he wanted to do. As I said, we got pregnant kind of early on in the relationship. He was making a good hourly wage. And I think I was about 5 or 6 months along when he decided he was going to take another job in a completely different field, making $6 less, no health benefits or anything. He had also cashed in 2 weeks of vacation time and decided he was going to spend that money on a bicycle, you know, not taking into account that once I had a child, he was going to have to be the sole breadwinner for at least a few weeks. You know, I thought the money would be better saved, but that's what he wanted. It was his money. How could I argue that? Shortly after Max was born, he decided that he wanted to join the National Guard. He was looking at it at that time. They had a nice bonus, an incentive, like $15,000, and then paying for education. So I saw it as kind of like a 5-year plan. You know, he's working towards something better. I'm not a perfect person. You know, recreational drug use, I was there, but I also wasn't responsible for anybody but myself and my own actions. I always maintained a job, a home, had food. You know, I never was in a position where I had to beg, borrow, or steal from anybody. I will go without before I will ask for something. But once kids are part of the equation, all that changes. You got to put all those thoughts on the back burner and you got to think about what's in their best interests. It got down to the point where I got no food in my house and I've got a hungry child, then I'm going to do whatever it takes to get that belly full. That's how any parent should be.
At one point, Sarah said, Max took to calling Kim mommy.
To have a child that isn't yours call you that and to feel that close with you. And that's where it was with Kim when they first got together. Now, I'm not sure if Scott initiated that or what the case may be. He was calling her mommy. And that, while it broke my heart to hear him refer to anyone but me in that regard, in the same respect, he's comfortable and he feels loved enough to consider you. And that aspect of his life, I actually sat down and thanked this woman at one point. everything that I had gone through. At one point, I was in the home that they shared when they first got together. When they first got together and they got a home, it was just a block away from Scott's parents' house, his father and his stepmother. Now, I know when Scott and I were together, we were looking into homes in that area as well. And for the two of us working, and I was a banquet coordinator at the country club at the time. And, you know, overtime, plus I get bonus pay, obviously full time and then some. It wasn't bad. Coupled with what he was pulling in, it wasn't fiscally possible between the two of us to have a house in that area. Now, knowing what he was doing, I think he was doing in some kind of machinery or working in a warehouse. He couldn't have been making, I'll even be generous and say $12 an hour. But there is no way he could afford that. I have no doubt that somehow he managed to accumulate enough for the first month's rent and security deposit. But then he probably didn't consider utilities, lawn care, general maintenance, trash pickup, water, sewage, you know, all those little things. Like, I handled all the bills. I was the accountant for the house. I took care of everything. For the most part, he was pretty free to spend however he chose. I made sure the bills were taken care of. Like, that was my first priority. I wasn't worried about bicycles and, you know, going out drinking with my friends and what have you. If we didn't have money for gas, I stayed home. That's just how it's got to be. You got to make sacrifices. At one point, we were living in Rexmont. I was driving Max all the way up to Robazonia to drop off at his parents' house, work a 12, 13-hour shift. I was wedding coordinator at that time. So I wouldn't get done there, you know, once the party's over, the reception, everything's cleaned up, put away, and, you know, still had to stay, wait for everybody to leave and lock the club down. I might not have been done till 3 o'clock in the morning. And now I got to drive another hour plus to go pick him up to only have to do it again the next day. I told you, Max did not a weight problem, but whenever I would take him for his doctor's visit, which I was informed I'm the only one that ever did that. The last doctor they had on record was the pediatrician that I had got him in with. General consensus was this was the best pediatrician in town. I managed to get him in with them, which is very difficult to do with new patients, especially the pediatrician. As luck would have it, blessed be, I managed to get him in there. He's on par with everything, but at one point he's like, okay, you know, he's you know, hitting all his milestones, but he's getting up there in his percentile for weight. I was still breastfeeding him. No problem. Start giving him a binky. Other than that, that was it. His Apgar score, I know when he was born, was almost perfect. Being that fair skinned, it's actually kind of commonplace for them to have a touch of jaundice. They just put you under that light. But he was done with that in less than 24 hours. Other than that, perfect. The little pockmark on his nose was something I was probably blowing out of proportion. It really was more aesthetic than anything else, but you never know with stuff like this. How does skin cancer starts out as a freckle? So you don't know. So I did everything, asked the pediatrician, well, what do you think? They said, like I said, stork bite. It's probably nothing, but I had Medicaid at the time, so premium insurance, why not run all the tests we can? Which was terrible because how it works when they have to do MRIs or CT scans on babies, obviously you have to hold very still. And anybody that has a baby knows that's not really their modus operandi. What they had to do was give him gas to put him to sleep. So they've got Scott holding the baby. And he's crying, obviously. He's uncomfortable. He's scared. All these people surrounding him. They put the mask over his face and he's still crying and he's looking at me and he's reaching out to me. And all of a sudden he goes limp. I freaked. They had to have me removed just to see that. Oh my goodness. And that's the moment that I knew I did have actual mothering instincts. To watch them go through any sort of discomfort. They're there with you. It's happening to you. Like, if right. You can take that pain and that suffering from them, it's... So the thought of what they exposed him to through all of this, just... Never in a million years could I imagine anything like this to be possible. I only ever saw a loving and attentive father. I mean, I guess in retrospect, when you only see your child for a few hours, you know, every other weekend, anybody can be loving and attentive and patient at that time. But for him to try to backtrack and try to say that Max had any sort of psychological issues, fetal alcohol syndrome, ridiculous. I wouldn't even smoke cigarettes when I was pregnant. But in the same regard, to suggest that even, you know, an irritation that could be brought upon by a troublesome child does not justify any level of abuse or neglect. Any whatsoever. There's no excuse for any amount of pain and suffering for any child to go through, much less what he was exposed to. The child that I remember was a sweet and loving little boy. He brought joy to everyone he came in contact with. There were no strangers to Max. You know, he had a smile for everyone. And it wasn't one of the awkward things that he would run up and accept a hug. Like, he had self-preservation, looked to his parents for social cues. Like, is it okay to approach this person? We weren't reckless about it. But everyone started out as a friend to him. When he met his baby brother for the first time, it was beautiful. My other son that was born, he's 3 years younger than Max. When I discovered he'd been cheating, coincidentally, our lease was also up for renewal. So we decided, I guess it's time to go our separate ways. There really wasn't much discussion about it. The night before, he had given me some story about a friend of his who got a flat tire in Hershey, which geographically from where we're located, why wouldn't his friend call his wife? Or I'm sure he's got friends and family that are much closer than you are. And here it is, like 1:30 in the morning, and I've never heard of this friend either, which is astonishing. He feels comfortable enough to call you at 1:30 in the morning to come help change a tire, but I've never even heard this person's name before. Okay, you know, want me to pack the baby up and we go with you to help? Oh, no. You know, you sleep. That's okay. I'll handle this. Well, he doesn't come home until, I don't even know. But it was a lot longer than it would have taken to change a tire. So the following day, I check his phone records. There's a number I don't recognize. So I called it and a girl answers. I explained, hey, how do you know Scott Schollenberger? Oh, I was with him last night. I'm like, well, you know, this is his girlfriend and the mother of his child. We live together. Could you tell me how far this went? Oh, yeah, well, we went out on a date and we kissed and I was it. That was done. I called him and, you know, I went off. Now I have concrete proof. And there was no, I'm sorry, no apology. He was more enraged than anything else that I had dared to go through his phone. And he started berating me. Oh, you think you're so smart? Like, I knew when you were going through my records. Well, then how come you weren't smart enough to call from another phone or do something? I have my suspicions that a few nights when I was working late at the country club, he told me that he was going to spend the night at his friend Jake's house and he was taking Max with him. I'm almost positive he took my son and went and stayed the night at another woman's house. I couldn't deal with it anymore. I've seen so many people stick it out for the sake of the child, but that doesn't work out. You know, that builds contempt and, you know, eventually a child's going to pick up on that. He was a horrible, horrible husband, but I always believed that he was an excellent father. I had no reason to ever think otherwise. I know he loved this child. He would protect it to the, I thought he would do anything to keep him safe and happy. But anyway, that was just an unspoken, okay, so that's it. We're packing up. We're moving. He's going to go stay in town with a friend of his who had a house. He worked two jobs. This man had like 7 kids and stuff. So he had a house with some extra rooms, space to spare because it was a shared custody thing. And he didn't have his kids at the time. So there was room. He had a finished basement that was empty. So there was room, you know, didn't have to get a storage unit or anything. He could put the large furniture in there. The day came to move. I paid for the moving truck. I paid his friends to come help him do the heavy lifting. I, you know, got them a case of beer. I ordered them pizza. But he just comes, moves the couches and the dressers, and then drops the truck off back to me since it was in my name. And that's it. I had to pay a babysitter to watch Max while we finished this.
The least he could have done when he finished was go pick up your son. But he just went about his merry way and called up some of his harem and got to live the single life for a little while. Oh, you're not anchored down to the ball and chain. Ain't got to answer to anybody. I covered your ass to get you to where you are. I supported you while you went through the National Guard. You know, you go off to basic training and leave me with a newborn. Supported you when you took a $6 loss. I tutored you to get your GED. I paid his child support for his older son out of my pocket. I paid for the car that you had to have. I paid for your insurance. I paid for your phone. I paid your late fees. I paid with everything. And that meant nothing. When I caught him cheating, he said he was prostituting himself for gas money. Prostituting himself for gas money. Like you could, that was his excuse for, yeah, he wasn't cheating on me. He was selling his ass for gas money. He didn't have money and he didn't have gas. And trust me, no one's paying for it. He had put on a considerable amount of weight. He wound up putting on, I guess, what was supposed to be my portion of the baby weight and put on so much weight that they would not allow him to go to basic training. The week leading up to his departure date, you know, he was doing training, meeting some of his, what would be his brothers in arms. And, you know, formed a bond. Like I said, he was constantly seeking some sort of validation, approval, wanted to be included, wanted to be respected, always trying to impress somebody, always had to be liked, didn't want anybody to think ill of him, responsible and strong and don't show any signs of weakness. That was always real big with him. I can't be weak. When he first got his divorce, like he invested himself into bodybuilding. Like that's where his extra energies went to. He got a weight set. To hear him talk, you know, he got into like MMA fighting, and I don't know how true that is, but you know, everybody's very impressed. But he did have a very nice physique, and you know, that was part of what initially drew me to him.
After her relationship with Scott ended, Sarah moved in on a temporary basis with a family member.
While I was staying there with them, I told them, I'll give you guys $100 a week, you know, help out with food and you know, whatever. You gave me a room. You got a roof over my head. At least I can do is give you something. I paid for my own food, whatever they wanted to use it for. Well, I'd already given my $100 for the week. And then she comes and she tries, oh, well, why don't you just give me the $100 for next week? And I said no, because her husband had pulled me aside earlier that day and said, stop giving her money because it's not going where it's supposed to be. They were struggling financially due to her kind of falling back into some bad habits. Well, I didn't find out until recently that at that point, my and her friend decided that they were going to get some sort of petty revenge on me. They went behind my back and called Scott, told him that I was out of my mind and not, I don't know the exact words that were used, but led him to believe that I was being irresponsible and Max could potentially be in danger, that I couldn't stay with them anymore because I was freeloading and just all sorts of terrible things that weren't true to the extent that she would have him believe. So had him come pick him up. And the situation he walked into was I had just pulled a pan of brownies out of the oven. Maxwell, I was just in the process of getting him into his jammies. Well, he had, I had the pan of brownies sitting on the counter. And, you know, 2.5, he was just about at the right height that he could stick his hand up and grab the counter. There's the pan of brownies with a big hunk missing out the middle. And here's my beautiful little cherub child covered in chocolate. It was a little bit late at night. It was like maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock. But so much for the bath that you had just had. So I'm in the process of trying to get the brownie remnants cleaned up and trying to chase this sugared up toddler and tackle him to the ground and get him changed. When I see Scott walk in with fire in his eyes, I see my friend who had been sitting out on the porch come in and give me this look with this little smug expression on her face. And Scott just says to me, I'm taking him, and that's it. That was the beginning of the end for me. At that point, I still had a job. I was waiting on tax money that came through shortly thereafter, which we were splitting. It was just a matter of business slowing down at the country club enough for me to go out and find another place to live. As I said, though, after he was gone, I kind of went off the deep end. I went reckless. I was self-harming. I'm ashamed to admit that I thought about ending it by my own hand. But, you know, I finally had a moment of clarity and decided I was going to fight. I was going to get better. You know, I'd started over before and I could do it again. After the incident at my family's home that he had removed Max from, I kind of went off the deep end. I won't lie. I was already depressed. I was already associating with some people that, you know, were less than ideal, definitely toxic. I was self-medicating. I thought I was building a future with this man. I thought we were going to get married, white picket fence, 2.6 kids, dog and a cat, you name it. You know, sky's the limit. I finally found me a good one. He's not into drugs. He's strong. He's handsome. He's got strong family ties. I should have looked a little further into that. But, you know, at first glance, it was different than anyone that I'd ever dated before. Someone that I thought I had a chance that we could have a future with. And in a blink of an eye, it's all gone. Here I am giving up a home again. I have no home. I have no furniture. The man I thought was in love with me has been seeing I don't even know how many women, lying to me, making me look like a fool because I committed myself to work and home. It was family or making money. And that was it. That was my life. I didn't go out. I didn't go partying. I didn't go out drinking. I didn't have friends. It the ultimate betrayal. And now, due to the actions of a vindictive pair of women, now my son is taking from me. Now I truly have lost everything. That was 2010. After that happened, I went off the deep end for a day or two. I wound up losing my job because I had missed some days at work, you know, locked up in depression. I had called and made arrangements for someone to cover my shifts, but didn't go through the proper channels and speak with a manager. I had a coworker that had, you know, considerable seniority. Everything was covered. The shifts were covered, but it wasn't done properly. And I respect that. I lost my job. That was like March 31st. On April 1st, I met my current husband, my second child's father. And we just hit it off right away. I finally found someone that could put a smile on my face through all this, pulled me out of the darkness for a while. So when he suggested, hey, well, he's from New York originally. He said, do you want to go to New York with me? I didn't have any better offers. Scott had run with my child. He wasn't letting me see him. I figured, you know, I'll go for a couple days, get away, get my head right, come up with a better plan. So I packed a book bag of belongings. I left the rest of my things at my family's home. When I decided it was over, most of the furniture was his, the big items, you know, the bed, the couches, that sort of thing. I had acquired all of Maxwell's bedroom furniture, his dressers, his crib that was, you know, a three-way convertible, went to a day bed and, you know, whatnot, a toddler bed, you know, the bed packs, the mattress pads, you know, everything. That stuff is, it's incredibly expensive. I don't spend that kind of money on myself. You know, first child, you know, you want to give him the best. I wanted to give him the world. I wanted to do everything I could for him. I was staying with my She had recently had a house fire in around Christmas time. So this was March. She was still trying to, you know, get her home back together. Her insurance company was able to salvage some things, but obviously not everything. So what little bits of furniture that I had, like end tables, coffee tables, lamps, that sort of stuff, she incorporated into her home. And the rest of it, I put in storage in her basement, you know, Max's bedroom suite, a lot of his toys. And we're not talking cheap stuff. Bouncers, baby Einstein. The kid was set up. Bags and bags and bags of clothing, bins, everything neatly organized, you know, like 30-gallon totes, shoes, you name it. Everything was, you know, 0 to 3, 3 to 6. Well, come to find out that while I was in New York, she sold everything. She sold his crib, his toys, his clothes, my cameras that had the memory cards that had all his baby pictures in them. And now I've really lost everything. I don't have a home. I have no furniture to put in it if I do. I have my husband's gone. My child's gone. I was devastated. So what else did I have to do? If I continued to stay there, I was on a fast track to devastation, basically. I was speeding through town. I was drinking. I had to stop. This is not the way that I'm going to get back in his life. So I removed myself from the situation, decided to take this man up on his offer and go to New York for a while. I wound up staying there a little bit longer than I had intended. But when I did finally come back, I was staying with a friend of mine out in Myerstown and found out shortly thereafter that I was pregnant, which allowed me to actually get into a local women's shelter in town. That was in 2010. While I was in New York, I maintained as much contact with Scott as I could. When he stopped answering my phone calls and texts, I would email him. And we went back and forth with that for a while until suddenly he just blocked me from that as well. Obviously, nothing on Facebook. I've only ever had one Facebook account my entire life. I wasn't one of those people that just kept on making new ones, made mistakes. No, I've remained consistent. Specifically so that there would always at least be that way for people to find me. Even on the Facebook account, I had listed Maxwell Schollenberger as my son, knowing how early children get into social media, or maybe even a friend of his, you know, joking around or looking, put your name in. Ooh, someone has you listed, they're your mother, that he could find me that way, or somebody could find me that way. When Scott had me blocked, I would have friends periodically try to hit him up through their accounts. He would block them as well. It was an exercise in futility. His parents cut me off, which they weren't too interactive anyway. They always seemed more concerned with the older son. I maintained contact with him as much as I possibly could. When the phone and the text stopped going through, emails, and then eventually he cut me off that. And then when that happened, I decided, okay, that's it. It's time to get back. So I pulled whatever resources I could come up with and finally got enough money together. He said I had no friends or anybody that I could call. Hey, can you buy me a bus ticket? I'm 100% on my own. The man that I was with, you know, my current husband now, he helped me get the money together and put me on a bus to come back. I was staying with my friend. Found out that I was pregnant, which then allowed me to get into the women's shelter in town, which is very nice. I think there were 6 rooms available. It was just for women and children. Each family was given their own room. And well, I happen to have my own bathroom as well. And then you had your own refrigerator, your assigned cabinet, shared common areas. It was good. It was a good thing. It instilled common practices. You know, there was like a chore list that everybody had to participate in. You know, you had to check in, you had to check out. Because some of these situations where it was abuse, they were on the run from a domestic issue. So shortly after, I can't even remember how I ran into them, but I find out that they're living just a few blocks from me. This was just Scott and Maxwell at the time. Scott got a little apartment. So around Thanksgiving, I make contact with him and Scott invites me over. I go to the store. Well, at the shelter, they donate a lot of food. So everybody got like a 12-pound turkey. So I was like, well, do you have any plans for Thanksgiving? Which struck me as bizarre that, you know, he wasn't going to his father's house. He wasn't going to his aunt's house. But I think, you know, he was still having issues, having gas money. My luck really finally seemed to turn around. I got a good job. I started working at the bank. I got a car, reconnected with Scott. I went over, I made Thanksgiving dinner, and, you know, it was a nice civil day. Discussed, you know, where have you been? Maybe he took some time to rethink what was going on, you know, see the work that I invested in taking care of Max while he was out doing whatever it is that he was doing. But I'm thinking, okay, so maybe this co-parenting thing's going to work. You know, maybe we can work this out. I didn't want to have to get the courts involved. paying child support and stuff, you know, if we both equally decide to contribute to his needs 50-50, you know, he needs clothes, we get him. He needs food, we buy it, you know, whatever he needs. Why do we have to have somebody regulate this when we could be adults and come to a common agreement between the two of us on when we're going to get to see him? But Scott just, he's always been a person that wants all the control and the final say. And it was always on his terms. Like, there was no regularity. And it's like, I had to always catch him in a good mood. And I was catering to him. But in the meantime, I'm riddled with pregnancy hormones. And of course, I'm emotional. Thanksgiving. It was comfortable. For a moment there, it was like when we just started out, when, there was still promise for the future, when he still loved only me. Since this happened, I just keep getting drawn back. Like, I can't imagine what it was like for my child to watch his father be loving and attentive with his younger siblings. I can't even imagine where his head was at with that. Like, did he think I abandoned him? Like, did he think I didn't love him? I can't take joy in a sunny day anymore. I feel guilty when I eat now. The other day I went outside and it's like, oh, you know, it's beautiful out. And then immediately my head just goes to, he was locked in a room with the windows covered. And that's not how it started out. When him and Kim first got together and he was at this extravagant house, I saw the room he was in. Oh, it was filled with toys. He had a race car bed, tons of clothes. I had, you know, showered him with gifts at every opportunity that I had. So, you know, he had a little four-wheeler and he was real into Toy Story. He got the new Buzz Lightyear and the Woody dolls. And just, I never in a million years would have foreseen that this was going to be the end result. I sat this woman down and thanked her for taking care of my son to the point where he was comfortable enough to call her mommy. Now, I also believe that she was not the first female to pass through Scott's life at that time, because when I did have visitation with him, he would mention other mommies, your real mommy, but then there was other mommy, and then there's Kim mommy. So he, at that point, he was allowing me to come pick Maxwell up here and there, you know, take him to the park. He would let me bring him over to the shelter every once in a while because they had this giant playground out back, everything fenced in, a nice yard. It was on Chestnut Street, so it was a busier street, but the yard was fenced in. It wasn't easy to get in or out of. They had a lot of security in the home for the various reasons. You know, we didn't know if there was domestic issues or what have you, but, you know, we want the families to feel safe. I remember one day I had Maxwell over at the house playing with some of the children, and they were all in the common area. They busted out some board games, cartoons were on. He had a good little thing going, and I had to run out to the car and grab a basket of laundry that I had just finished. One of the house rules is you cannot leave the children unattended. So two of the other ladies that shared the house with me were there. Hey, do you mind keeping an eye on him? I literally just have to run across the street and grab this basket of laundry out of my car. So I go out and I get the laundry. And as soon as I get in, they're like, hey, your phone's blowing up. And I see there's like 3 missed calls from Scott and all these texts, answer your phone. Like, oh, okay, what now? So I call him back and he's like, were you just crossing Chestnut Street? And I'm like, yeah, I had a basket of laundry. And he's like, and Max is with you? I'm like, he was in the house. No, my friend Kimmy said she saw him trailing behind you. You weren't even holding his hand and he almost got hit by a car. I'm like, what are you talking about? He wasn't even outside. His shoes aren't even on. I'm like, well, I assure you, he was not out there with me. And he just wasn't having it. He did not believe me. He says he will not sway from this whatsoever. My friend Kimmy saw him. He was with you. He almost got hit by a car. Pack him. Get him dressed. I'm coming to pick him up right now. I'm out front. Bring him out. I didn't want to cause any problems. You know, I, in my mind, we were doing good. You know, we were making progress. I figured, okay, well, this will all get sorted out. You know, he's going to rethink this, or she's going to reconsider what she saw. And, you know, we'll work this out. I'll call him later and we'll move on. Well, after that day, he started answering the phone less and less. Absolutely no visits since that moment. And I was devastated. We had a semi-regular schedule going where I was getting to see him at least like once a week, if not more. I knew it was coming up on my due date. And I decided, well, you know, I got a job, I got a car, I'm about to have a house. It's time to take this to the courts. Let them rule in my favor. Let's make it official then. Where we'd agreed before that we were going to keep it out of the courts. But at this point, I just couldn't. He wasn't being cooperative. Maybe I was being hasty, but to me, he was being unreasonable. I had rights, and he was abusing his authority. You're holding my child hostage. Like, you're using him as a pawn. I don't know if you still harbored some sort of ill will for the fact that it was so easy for me to move on. But, like, it seemed like he forgot that he's the one that betrayed me. At least I had the courtesy to wait until we were finished. I went through MidPen Legal Services and got a lawyer. We never went before a judge. I remember being in a room at one point where it was Scott and his attorney when they presented the proposal. Well, you can see him now, but you got to do 3-year analysis a week, and they have to fax the results to my office by Friday for you to see him for like 2 hours every other weekend, which at that point, I didn't have the attorney with me at the time, which I guess I should have called and checked. My lawyer that should have reviewed the proposal, I come to find out that he had accepted a position with another law firm and he had already quit and moved out of the city. He didn't even give me a courtesy call. Scott had a military appointed lawyer. I've never been to jail for anything but child support. I have never been to rehab. Nothing. There's nothing in my history on a permanent file, any way, shape, or form that is drug related. Like, this was completely over hearsay, which was another reason I was kind of like blindsided, but I thought, okay, so I'll do one or two. It'll just be temporary. And I didn't realize, you know, don't sign anything. I thought it was one of those take it or leave it type things. Either you agree to this or you get nothing at all. And in my eyes, something was better than nothing. So I agreed to it. His plan was all along. He knew I wasn't going to be able to keep it up. He was hoping, you know, eventually I'd give up and he would win. And he told me whenever I filed and they delivered the paperwork to him that I was going to regret doing that. He said, you are going to regret rushing this along. I told you I'm in control. But, you know, it had occurred to me that, you know, he has no basis for this, needing these drug tests and stuff. But the fact that I agreed to it, I guess, was an admittance of guilt. Again, I'm pleading ignorance here. I didn't have my lawyer with me. They insinuated that if I didn't sign these papers and agree to this, then that was like me giving up my rights, basically. And I didn't know any better. I'm just wanting to see my child. That's all. I worked so hard to finally get to the point where I was sufficient and able to provide him with a good home. I got this 3-bedroom, 2-story townhome. He had his own bedroom right next to the nursery, had his own bathroom. I had it all set up. He had his bed, toy, like everything. Like, he had his own room all set up the moment, you know, that they gave me the go-ahead, hoping they would come in and do a home inspection. Both me and my son's father, we were both working, you know, making good money, paying our bills. For about a month, we were going through the urinalysis, which I think the cheapest I could find was $60 a pop, $180 a week out of pocket. And then I come to find out he had also taken me for child support. When I got the job at the bank, the position that was posted was only a part-time position, no more than 30 hours a week. But more like 25. And that's it. With banks, they don't mess around with overtime. They're pretty strict with the way things are run. But obviously, I needed to do some training. So they were sending me up almost in Philly. So that was about an hour and a half commute every day. They gave me the option to get a hotel and stay in the area, which, you know, they would have paid for. But the shelter didn't allow that. They wanted everybody home every night and checked in. So they were reimbursing me for my mileage. They were paying me a stipend to eat. Lunch and dinner was covered. And then, of course, I was considered on the clock until I got home and also getting overtime. So they started me off at $9 an hour. So then 13.50 for overtime plus a quarter a mile or something. It was a pretty nice couple of checks. But it was those 2 weeks that domestics based their monthly figure off of. And then they started garnishing my checks completely unbeknownst to me. Instead of breaking it up, it would have been like $60 a week or something. I get hit at the end of the month with a $240 payment. Plus, I'm shelling out this money for the urine tests. Then my car, the transmission went out of it. And then I was still doing the urine test, but Maxwell had caught chickenpox. And I said, well, I can't risk him coming around the baby with this. He was only a couple of months old at the time. So I said, well, you know, could we do it next weekend instead? And then it happened. I was like on the phone, well, can I talk to him? And it was Kim that was on the phone. She had answered Scott's phone because it was his cell phone that I was calling. And she had answered. And I was like, oh, well, I'll let him know that you're not coming. And thinking, okay, you know what? I'm not even going to deal with you. Fine. And that was it. He stopped answering my calls, stopped answering my texts. The car went down. Shortly thereafter, I got so far behind. Obviously, I wasn't able to make it to work anymore. I was taking my son's father to work every day. He wound up losing his job. Having that considerable amount of money taken out of my last check, which would have covered the rent. You know, I'm still trying to pay utilities. It was it. We were getting kicked out of our house. We were being evicted. They worked with me as much as they could. I even went through a program, but it was no longer within my means. We wound up having to move to New York again to stay with friends of his. And again, we did the emails and stuff, but then that only lasted so long. Cut me off completely. And I didn't know what else to do. I was in no position to fight it. I had no money for a lawyer. Whenever we went to New York, I was powerless. There was nothing I could do. I had no friends or family that I was in touch with that knew what was going on. You know, none of them had heard from him. His parents had cut me off from their social media. They would refuse to answer my phone calls. I couldn't remember what his aunt's last name was to try to track her down on social media or anything. But at this point, I had every reason to believe that they were just going to give me more of the same. I was on anxiety and depression medication, which, if you're familiar with the Medicaid system, they only keep the mother insured, I think, up to 2 months after they give birth. And then they cut all that off. Now, all of a sudden, my medication is cut dry. And it was just an avalanche of misfortune, if you will. At this point, now I'm coming off of this medication. I have no one to talk to. The landlords actually contacted Children and Youth saying that if they have to evict someone and the person has minor children in the home, it's their obligation to notify CPS of the eviction. So, you know, they came in, they see he's happy, he's healthy, he's fed, you know, everything. The only thing I don't have for him, potentially, is a home. So we pack everything up and we go back to New York. So now, not only I have no legal representation, I'm not even in the same state, but now I can't pay my child support. So now there's warrants out for me. Scott, when the detectives originally contacted me, they said Scott told them that I was on heroin. It took it to a whole new level. I have never touched the stuff. I never did anything more than recreationally. Growing up, I dabbled in stuff. I wasn't always perfect, but I wasn't having to care for another living being. It was just me. I was still paying my bills, still going to that work. That doesn't excuse it. It's still illegal. I shouldn't have done it, but I did, and I'm sorry. And here's where I am now. And if I could take it back, I would. But I've never been in and out of rehab. I've never even been in rehab. None of this. In and out of jail. I've been in jail for child support. That's it. Like, if there's a way that they can look up my record, feel free. You'll see. He had to drag me through the mud so he could justify why he wasn't speaking to me, why he cut me off. Even when I had visitation with Max, when he was living a block away from his parents in Robinsonia, I come to find out that he told his aunt that I was still not in the picture, that I had abandoned him, that I made no attempt to contact him. Periodically, I would try to reach out. I managed to get some people on his, you know, to accept their friend request just so I can keep an eye on pictures and stuff. And for the first couple of years, there were the pictures of the new babies. He had three of them, like back to back. He had two of them so quick, I thought he had twins. I couldn't even go to Pennsylvania. I had warrants. I would pay what child support I could, but I was so far behind in arrears. And, you know, they were calling me to come to court because I'd missed dates and stuff. But I knew if I went, they were just going to arrest me. And I had another child to think of, to take care of. And I know a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, like you replace one with the other. That's I just thought me. Maxwell was in good hands. It killed me to have to walk away from it.
Unfortunately, I mean, he Scott forced your hand. He put you in that position and just kept exacerbating it. I hope that once people actually hear the circumstances of your story, that they will open their minds a little bit.
I was not contacted by law enforcement until June 10th, and they didn't even give me a date at that point. I had to contact the county coroner, who then referred me to the funeral home, who then told me that it was already too late. He'd been cremated, I think, 5 days after it happened, which also, like, blows my mind. That means that they had already conducted the autopsy at that point. They told me he'd already been cremated. I didn't even get to see my baby one last time. The last image I have of him was a picture on some other woman's Facebook page when he was maybe five. It's a picture of them as a family with all three of their children in the foreground and Maxwell's in the back like an afterthought. I was under the impression that you could not cremate the body of a minor child without express permission of both biological parents. So I believe, and I have good reason to, that they said Kim was the biological mother because initially, when they conducted the press release and the article was written, the one that I'd been forwarded with no prior notification from law enforcement or the CYS investigator I'd been in touch with, apart from an email they sent me that morning just telling me they were in custody.
But you had no idea what had actually happened. You just knew that he
passed away. Just based on the questions they had asked me, you know, is my 12-year-old son potty trained? Did he have any mental issues? Did he have any developmental delays? When's the last time he was to a doctor? Do you know if he went to school? Like, why do you not know these things? And he's 12. You know, they couldn't give me any details because it was a pending investigation. And I understand that, you know, I respect the chain of command and all that, you know, don't want to compromise anything. They had actually contacted a friend of mine on Facebook. I don't know why they didn't just message me directly if they saw that she and I were common friends. I always kept my privacy settings very open just for that very reason, so I could be easily contacted. My friend messaged me, check your messenger. And she said, this Detective Schaefer said, you need to contact him. It's about your son, Max. You're not in trouble. It has nothing to do with child support. And immediately, my heart just hit the floor. I've seen enough crime TV and whatnot to know if it's a detective, they're not calling to tell me that he needs a ride home from school. So I called him back. He just, you know, I'm sorry to tell you this, but he's dead. And that was it. I lost my baby twice. I mean, I guess in retrospect, after knowing what he'd been through and the condition he was in, that's probably not the last memory I would want to have of him. But I'd give anything to be able to hold him one more time. I didn't get to say goodbye. And now, you know, for all I know, he's in a plastic bag in some cardboard box tucked back into some closet, for all I know. Or this monster, like, just threw him out. I have no idea. I've called the DA's office. I've written emails. I have written correspondence between Scott and I, and I had even emailed Kim through this, asking if I could have his ashes. Scott was willing to hand them over, explaining that, you know, he didn't have the means to bury him or do anything along those lines. And Kim said that without some sort of written statement from Scott saying I could have them, that his ashes were not hers to keep or give away. All I could think was, well, neither was his life, but here we are. I did call the DA's office and spoke with Detective Wright, which is not the same detective that I was in contact with, who said he was the lead detective through the DA's office, and that was Detective David Schaefer. After speaking with these people for the months that this investigation is going on without them giving me any sort of information regarding what had happened, for me to have to find out through a news article, and I called the detective and I flipped out a little bit. I was reacting on emotion, which is another reason it took me so long to finally come forward and make any sort of public statement. I mean, as you can see, I still not 100% have my emotions in control over it. I just can't imagine what he went through. Watching his brothers and sisters grow and thrive and get birthdays and Christmases while he's forced to live in a room of darkness covered in his own filth, locked away like some dirty secret. If it was that bad, why didn't you just give him back? Any moment I would have found a way. I would have done anything. I would have swallowed any amount of pride.
There's no excuse. There's nothing a child could have done to earn that type of treatment.
This was prolonged and it was deliberate and they covered for each other and it was conscious and they knew what they were doing.
I asked Sarah if she ever officially gave up her parental rights to Max.
Everyone told me to. Just sign over your rights and they'll drop all the child support. I refused to. I couldn't. I would not do that. I knew that cutting myself off was bad enough that he had stopped all contact. I was damned if I was going to provide him with paperwork that embodied that and have him look. She doesn't even want you. No, no, that's not the case. I had hoped, you know, I couldn't come to Pennsylvania. I couldn't fight. I didn't have a lawyer. I didn't have the money. I didn't have the means. It took a while to get back on my feet after that one again. Here I am starting over, had another child, but I've been steady for the last couple of years, tried reaching out to him. But at this point, I had been out of his life for so long. I thought maybe it would just complicate things further. I knew how confused he was. Mommy, this mommy, other mommy. I'm thinking the last pictures I had seen, he's got three younger brothers. They're going on vacations. They're having a good time. They're happy. He's healthy. That's all that mattered to me. Of course, I wanted to be there and I wanted to be a part of that, but I thought he was cared for and loved. And I told myself, well, eventually when he gets old enough, he's going to ask questions and he's going to want answers and I will be here ready to give them to him. Good, bad, ugly. One day we're going to be together again and just not going to be in this world. It breaks my heart to know that this is not a unique case. That there's situations like this all over the world. Like even now, there's a child somewhere going through this same thing and nobody knows. They think nobody cares. Bottom line was, I thought he was in good hands. I had been to their home. I had seen what they provided for him at the time. Never in a million years would I have imagined something like this would have been possible. I didn't think Scott would be capable. I can't imagine what could have changed in his life for him to be so passive and accepted of this. For the people that say, you know, the boy was never loved and never knew, that's not true. He was my world and I gave him everything. I had a small apartment. For his first birthday, Scott was away, but we had a blowout party. I had a huge cake, a photo cake, him and his little Einstein bouncer. Oh my God, he used to love this thing. You know, boing, 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 and you'd hear the music would start playing, and he had the greatest little belly laugh and these chubby little cheeks with these little dimples, and it's just, his laugh could just light up a room. Remember his excitement about Santa Claus and his first Easter hunt and his first Halloween, he was a little bumblebee. We had Christmas and he was so excited that he got matching pajamas with his big brother. And I just hope, Scott said that he used to talk about me and tell him that I loved him. And I don't know, I want to believe that. I'm never going to forgive myself for the way things happened. You should have done more. Should have tried harder.
I think he tied your hands. Now, of course, you can think of all the things that you might have done differently, but you were working with what you had in the moment. And you had, like you said, another child to think of, and you couldn't end up in jail.
And by all accounts, I thought he was cared for.
Right. Yeah. It's easy to Monday morning quarterback a case like this, but it's so complicated. There's so many factors. And the bottom line is, who's at fault? Scott and Kim. Other people may have been able to do something had they intervened, you know, the family who lived nearby, whatnot. But it's hard to say. Again, if they were told he's living with someone else at the moment, how would they know that's not true? They trusted Scott. They trusted Kim. I'm sure they had no idea.
And you can see them catching, and they're caught up in their own lies. You know, mm-hmm. the families they were staying with saying that he had fetal alcohol syndrome. Even I saw one man saying that he thought it was obvious there was something wrong. That can't be true and accurate. But, you know, stuff like this can develop over prolonged periods of neglect. At the press release, Kim and Scott both admitted that he had no neurological disorders.
So for him to be telling different people throughout the years, different stories, it's almost as if they were creating their own narrative. Well, I definitely hope that telling your story will turn people around so that they have more of an idea of what actually happened, that you are also a victim in this. You know, you've not only lost your son, but you lost him twice. Of course, you took this long to talk about it. It's so far beyond complicated. No one could possibly understand or even anticipate what they would say or do in such a situation.
There was no simple explanation. Like, there were so mm-hmm. many contributing factors to what happened. I wish it was just, you know, from A to B, this is what happened. But there is no simple explanation.
I think that's the number one priority, is you need to have access to your son's ashes. There's no one else on this earth who should be getting them. The fact that they gave his ashes back to these people, that they were allowed to receive them while this investigation was going on, is mind-boggling.
And all she seemed concerned about was her Scentsy shop when this was brought up. That same day, she was making posts about her new products available in her Scentsy shop. And a few days later, she posted pictures of her three kids. No indication that anything was even wrong. A child's body had just been removed from your home, and there wasn't even a blip on the radar about it from either one of them. No remorse, not even a mention, not his name, like he didn't even exist to her. He called you mommy. That takes a special kind of heartless and cold person.
I do want to mention, you know, I think it's very important if anyone can help in any way as far as helping you get the ashes or any type of legal advice or legal representation, it would be amazing if they can reach out. We'll get them in touch with you because you deserve to be represented, but you also deserve to be reunited with your son. If anyone has any lead on how to get help with either of those things, you can contact me through the show's Facebook page or sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. Either way is fine, and we will definitely be able to get that information to Sarah, because that's the most important thing, is getting you reunited with Max as best as we can at this point. And I think also he knows how much you loved him. I hope you can keep that in your heart, that he knows.
Thank you.
I'm so glad we got a chance to have this conversation, and I'm honored that you are letting me help you get your story out there, because just seeing people say things without knowing a thing about you or your circumstances puts my teeth on edge. I can't handle it.
You don't know until you walk a mile in someone else's shoes.
I truly hope that hearing Sarah's story in her own words and her own voice gives the public a better understanding of the many factors that caused her to become separated from Max, and that going forward, people will treat her with empathy, like every grieving mother deserves. Rest in peace and out of suffering, Max. You will never be forgotten. That's it for this week, guys. Join me next week for another case. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLC Pod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from AudioJungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.